The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless Visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Do not underestimate the power of PlayStation.
Beyond.
Welcome, everybody, to Beyond number 489. I'm Max Scoville, and I'm joined today by Brian Altano, Andrew Goldfarb,
hello,
and Marty Sliva.
Good day.
We have a wonderful show lined up. I just got back from Star Wars Celebration, and boy, are my arms tired from lightsaber fighting, which I did a lot of at the Star Wars show. Anyway, I didn't do any of those things. but we do have Battlefront 2 details. I got to go to the whole press event thing for that. In other Disney-related news, because they own the entirety of our childhoods, there's also the Disney Afternoon Collection, which wraps up a bunch of classic NES games. We're going to talk about that. Marty, you're going full Goldfarb with Persona 5,
Dude, it's real bad. It's real bad. I'm very excited to talk about it.
Okay. I think it's real good.
And we have a new VR game to talk about, Star Blood Arena. What could that be? Well, you'll have to stick around to find out.
Wow.
Viewers,
you're a tantalizing
listeners.
Boy.
Yeah. So hosting the podcast.
All right. You're weird. I just want to talk about Star Wars Battlefront.
Okay. We can do that.
Sick man.
Yeah. So basically, they had like a. You all right over there?
You sound like a cantina.
I like that laugh.
Boy.
That was good. All right. That was like a laugh in a bad localized video game. Yeah.
Welcome to die. anyway, so Star Wars Battlefront 2, we got details on the campaign.
There's a campaign.
First of all, there is a campaign. That's cool. You play as a lady named...
Aiden Versio.
Aiden Versio. I don't know why I wrote that very late in the document. Yeah. Who is sort of the leader of the Inferno Squadron. And basically, the game starts out, apparently, sort of Battle of Endor, and it looks like you're part of this like sort of special ops team, sort of all-purpose kind of like not just TIE fighter pilots, not just like stormtrooper, but kind of doing like you're like just a badass.
Yeah. So
badass
you play an Imperial who's a very proud Imperial who comes from a lineage of high-ranking Imperials.
We'll get that to a second. Cool. But basically, totally like specialized treatment, and you go down. It looks like you get sent down by the Emperor to Endor to clean out those nasty rebels.
I mean, they're like the Navy SEALs, basically.
Yeah. And then you look up and the Death Star gets blown up, and you're like, "Oh crap!" But the whole angle is that this is trying to show the Empire from the Empire's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, they're not the bad guys. You grow up, like you said, on an Imperial world, and it apparently you're like, you know, I think your father's a commander or a Grand Admiral or something, you kind of grow up being like, this is awesome, and it sucks that these awful like rebel terrorists are trying to like take this away from us. So, I mean, showing the Death Star blowing up is sort of like a Pearl Harbor 9/11 moment from that kind of perspective.
Sure.
Of like, oh God, what did they do? Mm-hmm. And then the game apparently spans like almost 30 years, taking you up until like the formation of the New Order.
Yeah, it looks like it's just based on what they said in the release and looking at trailers, it looks like it goes from basically like that end of Jedi up until Starkiller Base. So I would assume End of Force Awakens.
Right, but
so
we don't know for sure if that's going to follow Aiden for all 30 of those years.
I would
assume not, because
we know actually that it will jump around a little bit. They've said that you will be playing as heroes and villains, like in the kind of the more overpowered sense.
It said specifically Luke and Kylo.
Yeah,
which is you'll be playing as in the single player mode.
Which is going to be interesting. You're going to kind of jump around in perspective. I'm curious how this is going to handle, just because
It's a massive, massive undertaking. It's being written by Walt Williams, who wrote Spec Ops: The Line. So there's a pedigree there.
An incredible game from the point of view of pretty much someone who's doing the worst things during war. Yeah.
And then an equally respected writer.
formerly of IGN, Mitch Dyer, who's been on this show. So, right, I mean, it's in...
Most notably for... I've known him. I think he threw up McDonald's in my Japanese shower when we were in Tokyo together. Yeah. This game's in great hands.
Saw him go to get a burrito and start trying to eat it on the way back when we were walking back to the office, and then the entire bottom half of the burrito just slipped out.
What do you think the Empire can learn from that?
So yeah, I mean, I guess honestly, full disclosure, going forward, anytime we talk about Battlefront 2, that a friend of ours is writing it. That being said, like, I don't know, I feel like we're gonna call.
And I do feel like the destruction of the second Death Star was sort of like watching the bottom half of a burrito. Fall.
You realize he compared it to Pearl Harbor and 9/11?
Okay, well, do you understand that like there weren't teddy bears on 9/11?
That's Anyway, the point being, this is like, it's one of those big, huge, galvanizing, like, oh my God, we've got to get back at them for this. Like, this is the kind of the attack that, and we always see like, you know, that the Empire is the bad guys. Mm-hmm. They've got the scary music and they're. But we're kind of seeing the flip side of that, because in Rogue One, there's those scenes where, like, Cassian has to, like, kill somebody, and you're like, oh, the Rebellion's kind of ruthless, and you've got Saw Gerrera being this, like, insane extremist.
Okay.
And then later this year, there's a book coming out called A Certain Point of View, which is an anthology of kind of famous Star Wars scenes retold from a different perspective, and being like, oh, there's different sides to
that's
kind
really
of...
That's really cool. I didn't know that was a thing.
Gary Whitta's got an entry in, and a whole bunch of other writers do. Yeah. And we've also seen Finn, obviously, in Force Awakens, who went from being a stormtrooper to... So we're seeing a lot of that different perspective, but I think this specifically, in like kind of humanizing the way the Empire would look at a situation like this, because, I mean, like, there's that whole Kevin Smith bit, right, about the contractors working on the Death Star, which I love. I think that I kind of hope that they stick to just being, like, by the end of the story, you're still like, the Empire thinks they are in the right on this. Like, they don't necessarily have a change of heart. I don't know how it's going to go, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think by bridging it into kind of unknown territory, like by starting in a well-defined space and by ending in a well-defined space, but having everything in between be sort of this like gray area, I feel like it'll work out okay.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it would be a lot harder if this were taking place between A New Hope and Jedi, you know, and something where like we feel like we have such a good grasp of everything that happens. I feel like by keeping that gray area gray, that they can kind of establish like what it is. And like it's interesting because like I'm assuming there will be events in this game we've never seen before, which means, again, unlike stuff from the original trilogy or from Force Awakens, like the first time we're seeing these moments will be from the Imperial perspective.
Yeah, I think specifically covering the ground between Jedi and Force Awakens, that 30 years is really only touched on in like Aftermath and a couple of other
Shattered Empires, Aftermath.
Yeah. Not a whole lot of stuff.
Again, like sort of everything else Star Wars that's coming out in the last couple of years, this is canon.
So these are
canonical characters, the thing that happens in this is canon.
What I really like is that Inferno Squadron has a lot of kind of red elements. They got like red stripes on their uniform and stuff, which is kind of like what that carries over to the First Order. They have like elite TIE fighters that have like red stripes on them.
You almost think like, is this the birth of that? Like, is this the embryo of that idea?
Yeah, and it's also cool because we're seeing ostensibly TIE fighter pilots with boots on the ground for the first time, guns in hand, instead of like out there flying around.
Yeah, exactly. Like infantry.
Yeah. It's really cool.
I think it's awesome because you mentioned Inferno Squad is like the name of their elite team, but also there's a novel coming out called Inferno Squad that'll kind of, they're calling it a Rogue One sequel was the way they announced it, which is a really interesting way to phrase it to me, because it's really a hybrid Rogue One sequel, but also
called Star Wars Battlefront Inferno Squad.
Yeah.
There are four movies that are technically Rogue One sequels.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's why it's cool to just like, you know, they wiped the extended universe or the expanded universe when they announced the new trilogy, and so I'm glad we're getting that filled in a canon way now.
Right.
Rather than like all the weird stuff we read as kids that's totally out the window now.
Yeah. So I actually asked in the, we did like an interview afterwards, and I was like, talking to one of the story group guys, I was like, so is this going to dip into stuff that's expanded universe? And he was like, do you mean like the new stuff that's comics and books and all that? Or do you mean like the old stuff that isn't canonical? And I was like, oh, that's, you don't even think of this as expanded universe. This is just Star Wars.
This is the universe. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, on that front, we got to see sort of a behind the scenes video that was really interesting because it had some of those sort of, it was sort of like a developer diary type thing that, you know, EA always does when they're like, we haven't finished the trailer, you know, but there were a few little like tidbits that kind of gave some insight to what the gameplay is actually going to be like. And it seems like First of all, I think there were some shots in third person, so I think you're going to be able to kind of jump between first and third, as you might expect.
But it
looked like single player.
Oh, that's cool.
And there were shots of there's that little robot, little kind of probe droid looking thing that Iden has with her at all times.
The ID-9 seeker droid.
Yeah. Is that what it's called?
It's from Rebels.
We were looking it up yesterday.
Okay, cool. Well, good. Yeah, they also have the Imperial Raider assault ship, which is like that kind of mini.
We're putting up sort of like a – I wrote a rewind theater type of thing for the major trailer on this that we're putting on IGN soon. It just – peeled it apart and looked at every single.
I'm going to bet money, absolutely not knowing this, that droid, your little shoulders droid, is going to be able to scan things, because literally every game I play this year, you're able to scan things.
Yep. That's true.
They actually demonstrated that it, I think they showed
you can email it to yourself.
Kind of early kind of gray box gameplay, but it you can like sort of mount it on a wall. I think you can basically turn it into a turret, and they showed some of like, one of Iden's abilities is like, using basically like this square kind of force shield, which looked very much like that shield out of was it Fuse,
the Egg.
So like I mean they've used it in other games that just came to mind, but
they've used it in other games.
They also had a shot of her doing like a takedown with like a kind of a baton.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's going to be stealth elements in there, and I mean some of these might carry over into into the multiplayer component, but like
because there was really no stealth stuff in multiplayer. And there was melee options for certain characters, certain heroes and stuff like that. And then you always had that sort of like last resort bash on the stick to kill somebody.
They added a bunch later on in the DLC. Like one of them, it became like a star card to do like a somersault, which is kind of like...
And like rolls and stuff like that.
It's like, what other moves you got? You're like, you do like a little roll. And, all right, that's like, I used to use that for thermal detonators and jetpacks, but sure, why not? Meanwhile, they talked a little bit about multiplayer, and one thing they kind of kept touching on was that there are now progression systems for basically everything. It's class-based, for starters, which is interesting, because before it was like kind of you pick your loadout. It was very sort of like very stripped down. You pick two star cards and a weapon, pretty much. Don't know if it's going to be like, if you carry multiple blasters now or what the deal is, or if you still have star cards, but they said that basically you're able to upgrade heroes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's like in the sort of like kind of MOBA sense where you're able to upgrade them within a round, or if it carries over between matches.
I really like the idea that like the Luke at the beginning, your hero Luke is New Hope Luke. And that through the course of like progression that you're able to get a, end of Jedi Luke.
Yeah. Right.
Like, cool. Which I think that'd be really cool.
I think they could honestly just get a lot done just with skins and stuff, just kind of mixing it up visually.
I really hope it retains, like, we mentioned before, like, in interest of honesty, like a friend of ours who had a burrito break in his hand is writing this game. But Max and I gushed about the first Battlefront game for like 200 hours on camera.
That was while Mitch still worked here.
Yeah. I mean, when everyone else had moved on, we were still sort of like geeking out about little things.
Yeah.
It was definitely annoying.
Yeah.
So we're huge fans of the game either way, regardless of who's working on it. But one of the things I really hope it does retain is the sort of quick and fun kind of arcadey feel of it. Like, I don't want this game to get too lost in the sort of competitive MOBA sense. I do want it to be kind of casual. And I know you're watching this probably being like, no. And I'm like, well, it's Star Wars. Like, I think it should be accessible.
Yeah.
Like, there's plenty of a weird, obtuse Star Wars games out there.
Yeah.
They get a little too deep. And I think Battlefront being quick, pick up and play and accessible and arcadey is something I really look for. So I hope they can maintain that again while still giving us a lot more options than the last game had.
Yeah. Well, and they also touched on some things briefly that fans wanted in the first game, which are Criterion's working on, like full-fledged space battles.
Yep.
We don't know, again, if it's going to be, all right, go into the space battle mode, or if it's going to be something to the scale of a No Man's Sky, get in a plane, go into orbit, and then all of a sudden you're out of orbit.
I get the sense that it's going to be sort of a separate mode.
Yeah.
I asked a little bit about just what they're doing. They've got vehicles, obviously. They showed Tauntauns in the teaser and everything, and there's going to be, I think, land speeders, and there's Rontos and things like that. And I asked, like, do you see animals as being... Are they heroes or are they vehicles? Because like, if you can, I don't know if it'd be awesome if there's a Rancor, but would they see that as a mount or is it something you play as? I mean, that's obviously getting ahead of myself. They haven't shown any Rancors or anything.
God, I hope there's a Rancor.
One thing they talked about was having a resource system for like upgrading stuff, and they sounded like they'd basically retooled the idea of having pickups, because in the first game, obviously, there'd just be like sort of a medallion floating on the
disc, yeah.
And everyone would be racing towards it, and you'd be like, well, I didn't get a TIE fighter or a rocket launcher or whatever the hell it was.
Yep.
So I think they're trying to move away from that whole thing where it's if you pick up this thing and you get to be like Luke Skywalker for 30 seconds, you know? It sucks. Like, I've played that game for I don't even know how many hours, and I feel like I've been able to fly Slave 1 maybe 5 times.
Yeah, that's kind of ridiculous, right? Yeah. Like, it's always a race at the beginning of those matches to get it. And even, like, having multiplayer modes where you're on foot most of the time, but the item pickups are ships, you would get into one and, like, get shot down immediately or crash into something, and it was not very forgiving. And I know a lot of that's like, oh, get good, but still, like... It shouldn't feel like there's that chance of instantly getting punished for something like that. I mean, or at least if there is, make it a little easier to get into those.
I'm hoping gameplay is balanced in general by them spreading it out among studios. Like, I mean, it is very exciting to be hearing like Criterion's handling vehicles, DICE is still doing like the core multiplayer component, and now Motive is doing campaign. Like, hearing that collaborative effort across EA Studios is really smart, and that makes me excited for what they're going to do with all the Star Wars games, because we know Respawn's lead on one, but I'd be very surprised if they're not sharing in some capacity with other studios. So I think it's going to be cool watching kind of this, like, theoretically, we're getting an EA Star Wars game every year now, and like, who knows when Battlefront 3 fits into that, but like, we know Amy Hennig's game, and we know Visceral's game, and we know Respawn's game are somewhere.
Right.
So it's exciting.
It's sort of as how Ubisoft games, there's a lead studio, but then there's auxiliary studios.
Yeah, or Call of Duty.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I'm concerned about is that they're going to lean too hard into this being a hero shooter, and there's going to be heroes and villains mode, which was in the first one. Yep. The heroes and villains in the first one were like, the balance was weird.
Yeah, no, it was janky. Like, it never felt totally polished like the rest of the game did.
And they didn't have enough of them. Like, when that game launched, I think it was, it was 3 heroes and 3 villains?
And some were so, like, Boba Fett was so much stronger than, like, Leia. Yeah.
Well, it's weird, because I feel like the older I get, the more Star Wars means to me sort of the universe and the atmosphere and the planets and the music and the art direction and the props and the weapons and the animals. Mm-hmm. And then less about, like, I want to be Luke Skywalker and I want to be Leia.
Right.
Like, playing as those characters in Battlefront was cool. There was a good novelty to it. And I remember getting really excited when we found out about Chewbacca and Greedo and Bosk and seeing their weapons and stuff be included in the game. But the actual, like, sort of boots on the ground of playing as those characters was never really that fun. And the hero modes specifically in that game were some of the weakest to me personally. I understand why other people like I have friends who are casual Star Wars fans who like went crazy for those modes. Those are their favorite parts. But I'm like, I'll totally play as a stormtrooper or a snowtrooper for 10 hours.
Well, those modes were also really cool because they let you get a chance to actually play as a hero or a villain when you couldn't in the main game, because somebody would always like book it over to, they knew where the coins were, and they go pick them up first, and they'd get to the second you got to be Lando, you're like, oh, how does this work? And then you get shot, and you're like, well, never mind, I don't know how to play as Lando.
But I hope they really
another 10 hours to find him.
Yeah, I hope they really clean up the like the way those characters are animated and the way they control and stuff like that, especially if they're specifically weaving them into the single player stuff. Because I think it's going to be kind of jarring to go from playing like Iden's story, where you're like, I'm really invested in this, to suddenly being like, I'm Luke Skywalker and I have to fight the bad guys.
Right.
Like, it feels a little goofus and gallant. it's not necessarily something I'm looking for.
The big thing that's happened between Battlefront 1 and 2 is Overwatch. And I think that EA does not have a hero shooter right now. And I think this is their chance to be like, part of this is hero shooter type stuff. And I think they're going to... You know, they kind of were toying with it in the last one, and I hope it's not like a full-blown, like, sort of a, you know, sort of MOBA-esque, but, I mean, if they have a mode that just puts an emphasis on, like, pick a unique character, everybody gets one character, you know, and then you're out there, and assuming they have enough of them, the cool thing is this time around, you know, there are prequel characters in there, too, so if you manage to have this, like, crazy mode where it's just a bunch of Star Wars characters in different eras running around, it could be really cool.
Yeah.
I think they've said that they want to make it... I might have heard this wrong, that they want to make the hero characters feel more grounded, you know, and they were really overpowered in the first game. And obviously, if there's a resource system and upgrades and stuff, it's going to be kind of like, oh, work your way up there and figure it out.
Especially in campaign. Like in multiplayer, it's one thing when you have them for a limited time. But like in a campaign level, they can't be 10 times more powerful because you would just mow through
faster,
everything.
Or faster, too. Yeah. Like it just felt like they were from a different game. Like Luke Skywalker would show up and he would just zip across the screen, do flips, and kill
Vader.
Six people. And Vader was like, Vader. I mean, Vader should always be menacing and terrifying. Yeah. But it got to the point where it was just like, all right, we got it.
Now, one thing they talked about is that there's a class system now. And basically, I don't know if they didn't say any of the classes, but they showed this image that had, it had like a rebel Endor trooper, and then it had a First Order stormtrooper, and then it had a Imperial officer, and then it was a battle droid. And I think the suggestion was, I think the implication there was, this is the same class.
So if you upgrade that battle droid, those upgrades go to that First Order troop.
Right.
My
concern with that is that how do you make a game where one of those chubby little doughboy First Order stormtroopers controls like a battle droid, which is built like a weird like skeleton man?
Right.
What do you want the battle droid to like control, like Quap or Octodad?
No, I want the battle droid to be like a weird little like, just terrifying like fast skeleton. You know,
I don't like that.
I don't know. I'm curious to see what they do with it. Like, seriously, I'm glad that they're kind of keeping it like, okay, so there's it's totally not going to be canon regardless. It's going to be like a nonsense game where, you know, like Boba Fett like comes out and kills Lando and then like a bunch of people like come over and like teabag him or whatever.
Yep.
I love that part of the movie.
But I like that they're going to have it on like, oh, this is the class.
A little higher.
Yeah. They're not going to have like battle droids running around Cloud City unless they do some kind of weird prequel or Cloud City version.
Right,
where
right.
You know, mining for different types of gas.
That was back when it was Cloud Town.
Yeah, Cloud Town. Yeah.
I think that's the thing, too, is like how many maps are going to carry over from the first one. Like what I learned last time around was that in many ways there's kind of no satisfying everybody. Like they made Tatooine and they made a bunch of maps on Tatooine and people were like, all right, well, what about Jakku? And they made Jakku and they were like, too many sand planets. Yeah. And like, all right, well, here's Hoth. Okay, cool. Why didn't you do this part of Hoth? So now if they carry over all that stuff, because none of it is ever going to be as much content as the people sort of imagine they remember from the Battlefront games that they played growing up. Even though I think that like in terms of like art direction and sound and texture work and the Star Wars feel that you got playing Battlefront, like it was night and day playing.
There were more maps in GoldenEye.
Yeah.
But the maps weren't, by and large, weren't good in GoldenEye.
Yeah, so exactly. Like, there are also three based on that one part in the library scene.
Oh, the archives, the library, and the basement? Yeah.
Like, Xenia reads a book in the library. Like, there's four levels based on that. So we'll see how much of that stuff they carry over. I think they have to do all of it, but I don't know how many legacy maps they need to do. I think, like, specifically they said they're doing Mos Eisley now, which they did, like, Tatooine levels, and they did the sort of area where you see the Millennium Falcon sort of
hangar.
The hangar.
Yeah, that was like a weird sort of remix approach.
Because Luke's house was in the background.
It was
like
half a rebel base kind of thing. It didn't really quite make sense. It wasn't quite Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I like them talking about canon locations in the campaign, because generally that'll carry over to multiplayer maps. And I don't know, like that feeling of authenticity in Battlefront is just like no other Star Wars game. Like
we also saw a bunch of planets we've never seen before. There was that one that's very, it's like half sort of Empire architecture and half like red bonsai trees.
That's Jin's home, or not Jin, sorry, Aiden's home planet. And that's the one, like that planet willingly was like, yeah, we'll go under Imperial occupation. And they were like, hey, being under the Empire has been fine. Like, they've been great to us. So anyone on that planet was like, no, this is great. Why would the rebels ever want to take them down?
No, it's like, it's first world stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So actually, one thing they're doing that's awesome, they showed us a bunch of like bits and pieces of this like behind the scenes stuff. They're doing photogrammetry again, which is obviously in the first time around, they were like, we went to ILM and took a bunch of pictures of the original AT-AT models, and then we put them in the game, and they're accurate. In this case, they're also going to physical locations and photographing them, but this time they're kind of going off the beaten path. They're not just going to Star Wars locations and photographing them. They went to, they said Osaka, and there's this place there where there's a bunch of extremely brutalist architecture, and then cherry blossom trees, and that's kind of what they took for this.
That's really cool.
For the new, new
that's
city.
Awesome.
They showed us some stuff that was like, and I think this wasn't for like multiplayer or anything, but it'll probably show up in there too. It was like this kind of weird, heavily craggy, very Mediterranean looking kind of volcanic ocean area, and I don't know what area it is, that what planet that is, but like the thing I'm incredibly excited about here is what's the prequel stuff going to look like, because there is almost no chance that it doesn't look considerably better than the actual movies.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they can make a Camino in 2017 that looks better than the Camino that
correct
what, 2003
absolutely.
Or whatever, 2002.
They showed concept art of a Camino like level. Oh, yeah, it was all like just very sketchy, but it had a Republic or a Jedi starfighter chasing Slave One, and there were Republic gunships in the background. I'm like, that looks sick.
Yeah, and it was just like pouring, and it looks different than anything in Battlefront
like,
One.
You watch Episode Two, and the Clone Wars starts, and you know Geonosis is there, and it all has that kind of weird like PS3 cutscene haze over it because that was the first movie ever shot on digital. That was a groundbreaking thing. It was still sort of figuring out how to do what it was doing.
Or look at the Gungan battle scene with those bouncy balls on that Windows 95 wallpaper.
Now,
Phantom Menace.
Like. Rolling Fields.
Here's what I really want to know about. They said prequel era stuff, and everyone always goes, some people go, ugh, prequel stuff. And some people go, that means Clone Wars. And then they go, Clone Wars, yes, and that's Revenge of the Sith and all that. I want to see the Battle of Naboo.
Yeah,
I want Naboo
Starfighters.
Totally. I want Gungans running around. I want to see what a Gungan looks like in Frostbite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want those big, gross bunny ears flopping around, just 60 frames a second.
I can't imagine.
Floppy folds.
I want to see Captain Tarples in 4K.
No one wants to see Captain Tarples in 4K.
I can't imagine you don't get that.
I want to see spit flying around.
I think any big set piece from those movies will at least be glossed over. Like, because look at what they did with DLC for Battlefront 1. And like they've said there won't be a season pass for this or anything. But like I have to imagine they'll fill in, you know, even if like first round we're not getting every single thing, like eventually they're going to fill in Gungans. They know people love to hate having like
there's also
Jar Jar will be a hero eventually.
There's also plenty of room to hide that kind of stuff in the margins too.
Yeah.
Like the last game had a Tauntaun frozen in ice. It had Ewoks running around the Ewok village. Like if you got to the right area at the right time, they would run into these little doors and hide.
You could find Captain Panaka's skeleton.
Yeah.
With that weird red hat.
Yep. There's a scene where Jabba the Hutt's making out with a Minoc.
Oh, God.
How would that work?
I don't know.
With tongues.
It'd be like you making out with a hummingbird.
Yeah, or a Minoc.
Really weird. Really weird.
Also, the game's coming out November 17th.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But how much will it cost?
$60.
Yeah, but what about the season pass?
I don't know.
They don't know. Somebody's like, there's no season pass. Somebody else is like, there's. That's not true.
What if it's not a seasonal pass?
Like this?
I don't know. Are we going to see like battle packs, loot boxes?
So this is my concern, right? Like there was so much backlash against the pricing model of the last one because it's like, oh, it's $50. But that's a lot of money. Yeah, I know. The video games are expensive hobby. It sucks. Like, make paper airplanes. They're free. Read. Go to the library. I don't know what to tell you. Video games, they're expensive. It sucks. Like, or you know what else is expensive is going to do literally anything. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to spend like $200 on like random loot boxes to be like, oh, I did these scratch offs to get Bossk's gun. Like, I would rather just, if there's an option to give somebody $50 to just be like future proofed with this thing and just have every Star Wars thing ever. Like, if in a year and a half they're like, we made those Gungan balls, I'm like, cool, do I have it already? No, you gotta win the lottery for it. Like, I don't wanna do all that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the games are moving away from segmenting their audience by being like, maps are only for season pass holders. Or, I mean, like, I like the idea of doing what some games have done where maps just come to everybody, but you're buying cosmetic things. But like, I mean, you know, I get it. I think looking at how crazy it is right now and how hard it is to be like, I'm going to play Persona and Horizon and Zelda and Nier and all these other games coming, like $50 is a whole other game, basically.
It is. But what I did like about it was that it was sort of like future proofed my ability to keep checking in on that game. Was that I paid for something once, and then every quarter, every few months, going from Jakku to Scarif, they were like, here's new stuff. And between all that, I got like Bespin, I got Jabba's Palace, I got the Death Star and Chewbacca.
Yeah, yeah. Also, you're paying as an early adopter.
Yeah.
Like that's a reality. If you waited a year, you could pick up the baseline Star Wars Battlefront for $40.
Yeah, or the deluxe edition was up for like $17.99 at one point. Like,
yeah.
So I mean, everything is cheaper if you wait.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, if you don't buy a console at launch, eventually you can get it for $200. Like,
yeah.
That's a reality. But do you want to play it brand new or what?
So all I'm saying is, like, I don't really care what they do, but I do hope they give me, like, the option to just pay once and get everything forever.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm really excited about this.
Yeah.
I think that I hope that there's some just... I hope that there's some fun nonsense in there. I hope that they got enough kind of confidence for the first one. I think also the first one, I don't want to say rushed, but I think they were trying to hit that Force Awakens window.
Yeah.
And they did, you know? And they
it was definitely light on modes at launch, for
but they've,
sure.
They've been working on this one, I think, since then, so...
Yeah.
It seems pretty robust, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
And the people not interested in Star Wars will stop talking about it for probably a month until E3, and then we're going to start talking about it again.
Yeah, yeah.
But less than that.
And, yeah.
To be honest. Have you met Max and Brian?
Yeah. How could you not be interested in Star Wars? What's wrong with
Star
you?
Wars.
Watch The Hobbit.
I don't like The Hobbit. Why?
I like The Hobbit and Star Wars.
I'm talking to you. I was talking to people that don't like Star Wars.
All right. So anyway.
That do like The Hobbit.
They're both. Anyway. The Disney Afternoon Collection is out. Is it? Did
yeah.
it come out? It's out. It's
out
now.
Today.
Okay. It's $20. It's 6 games. It's DuckTales, DuckTales 2, Chippendale, Chippendale 2, Tailspin, and Darkwing Duck. And it is pretty much the Mega Man. What is it? The Mega Man Legacy Collection?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But for those Capcom games, yeah.
It's Capcom worked with Frank Cifaldi and a bunch of other really talented people over there to sort of make this definitive archive of a collection of classic NES games together for the first time. I think with Mega Man, we've seen like there was the Mega Man collection on GameCube and PS2 yeah. and a bunch of other. I thought you said Cuban PS2. It's only available on Cuban PS2s. But this is the first time we're seeing all six of these games together in one place, yeah. which is really cool because I grew up with these games. These are some of my favorite games to play as a kid on my NES,
yeah.
when I wasn't watching the Disney Afternoon after school,
yeah.
Which was like this weird thing, you would get home from school, just open up a box of like string things, and then just sit there and just like get sugared up and watch a bunch of like
string
animals solve
things?
Crimes.
What are string things?
They're like these gummy ropes.
What's wrong with you guys? You don't know about string things?
You didn't have string things?
Was that?
They were like
the foot.
They were like if the Nazca lines were made of corn syrup. There's just a bunch of weird Aztec drawings where you peel them off and eat them like spaghetti.
I feel like from
you didn't have string thing.
They were like Slim Jim's brain damaged cousin that just came like smattered all over a piece of wax paper.
From string,
I like the word smattered in that context.
From string things to kombucha should be your autobiography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, string things, those
only available on Cuban PS2.
But one of the cool things about this collection is like Rare Replay, there's a bunch of like sort of museum features and rewind features in every game to where you can automatically rewind because these games are hard as balls. Like these games are hard and they're unforgiving, and that's what the 8-bit era was like. And the fact that you can get through these games without bashing your head against a wall by doing that is really cool.
Totally. And I think what's really interesting about a bunch of these games, DuckTales specifically, is sort of non-linear.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Chippendale Rescue Rangers. Like after you beat the first or second level, the map opens up and you have different areas to go to, and you can skip entire levels if you don't want to. Chippendale is one of the first like co-op games I ever played on the NES, where like two players can play at the same time and you can throw each other and you beat each other up and stuff like that. So it's really cool. But the cool thing about this game is sort of the packaging around it is incredibly 90s. Yeah. Like it's got that Saved by the Bell theme song look where there's just like triangles and squiggly lines flying everywhere. And you get into the options menu and there's tons of galleries, concept art. There's like they flat pack high res scanned all the boxes of packaging and manuals. There's drawings from KJ Inafune who did like all the old Mega Man stuff. Mm-hmm. And I saw Frank Cifaldi tweeting about this, but you can tell the way he draws eyes, Mr. Inafune, that like he drew the DuckTales characters and they all just have this like weird menacing look to them, which is great. They look like Mega Man bosses. So cool. All that stuff's in there, all the concept art. There's an entire music selection thing. You can listen to all the sound. Once you get into the actual game itself, like we said, there's the rewind feature, but there's also different graphic settings. You can switch over to widescreen. You can add borders. You can add old CRT filters, which like get added to a lot of these games, but I think like look legitimately good this time around.
And
it's $20 for 6 games, and like it's a totally cool deal. Like,
Also, like you were saying that they went through and they rebuilt a whole emulator. Like this is they're not going to have any like latency or
it's as good as these games can look.
Totally. Yeah, like they did they didn't just like port some emulator nesticle whatever nonsense or something like that.
It's also got the director's commentary by Ross Perot and Michael Dukakis.
That's right.
Yeah, luminaries of the era.
Wow.
Yep.
I hope we get more of this. I hope we get a second one
of
these.
Crap,
that has,
yes.
It's fascinating that it was like Capcom, Disney, Nintendo, and Sony were able to like somehow somebody was able to navigate that rat's nest of legality and rights and stuff.
Well, that was like Super Star Wars coming to PS4 last year. Like there's little I love seeing stuff like that happen.
Or like the fact that these old LucasArts games
like Full Throttle.
Full Throttle coming to PS4. And I'm like, man, how did they work that out?
Yeah, Full Throttle's got that great option to just like click over to the old graphics and stuff.
Like Wonder Boy has that too.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool. Like, in lieu of seeing like definitive remakes of these games or anything like that, which I'm not really sure I want, because we got a remake of DuckTales and it didn't really pan out.
Yeah.
The original version of that game is still pretty much flawless to me.
Perfect music. Some of the best music.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. So this is really cool. Like, I'm very glad this is happening. I understand the hurdles it takes to get Disney and... What are you doing? Moving my stuff around?
I'm doing anything.
I'm gonna hit you.
We're gonna get emails about you hitting him.
It's not true. I always said people hate each other.
No, we got a message right now. It's Brandon Hoffer says, please don't hit Goldfarb. No, not really. He asks, have any of you played Disney Afternoon Collection yet? And if so, which title is hitting you hardest in terms of nostalgia? I used to play Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers a lot on the NES, and it's fantastic now that I can play it on today's consoles.
Yeah.
Did you guys, Marty and Goldfarb, did you guys play these games?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I didn't play all of them.
I never played Tailspin.
So that's far and away the worst game of this collection.
Really?
It was the worst game back then, and it holds up the worst.
It's a shmup, right?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah.
I feel like I only played DuckTales, Chip and Dale, and Darkwing Duck.
So my thing is, I go back and play DuckTales relatively often, and so I'm less nostalgic about that. Going back in this collection and playing Chip and Dale's, I thought was really cool, because that was a game I played so much as a kid, but I haven't touched probably since I first downloaded Nesticle, like 15, 20 years ago.
I did the same thing today. Now, you have to keep in mind, like, these weren't ported to virtual console. They haven't been on other platforms.
There was no remaster. Like, there wasn't.
I sat down today and started playing it and went through the first 3-4 levels without dying and then just, like, wrecked bosses without getting hit. And I was like, that's terrifying that I just have that there. Mm-hmm. So I think if you played these games growing up, like, you might be kind of amazed at yourself at how quickly you just lock in on them again. Like, it's pretty fascinating.
It's been awesome just walking around hearing the music and just seeing people, like, because we only have a couple of people in the office playing, but, like, man, it really does. Like, I don't know if it's one specific game that hits me that hard, but just, like, watching people, like, hit that era, I don't know. It's like there's something very special about watching anyone play any NES game, where it just, like, immediately brings me back to, like, my dentist had an NES and I never owned an NES, but, like, my friends had them, so it was, like, more of, like, the borrowing or renting thing.
And it's also cool to see, like, Sam and Damon playing them in the corner, who obviously grew up with them, and then someone like Jonathan walks by and wasn't born when some of these came out.
Yeah. And he's like, what is this? And you're looking at it for the first time. It's also it's important to note that licensed games have and always kind of will be few and far between in terms of them being great in quality.
Yeah, DuckTales is such an exception, though.
It's very odd to see something like that Capcom was sort of working with Disney at the time to make really cool, really polished, just awesome AAA licensed video games. And that kind of went away. So, yeah, it's cool to see these back. Like we said, $20 out now. If you're feeling it, like, go for it.
I hope this sells well, and that, like you said, we get a sequel with 16-bit games, like Aladdin and Goof Troop, Lion King and Mickey Mania.
I want Mickey Mania so bad.
Yep.
I think you want to play Lion King again. People don't remember.
Lion King actually sucks. Like, the second level of that game is very bad.
I Can't Wait to Be King, where you jump on those animals' heads.
Yeah.
I hate that level. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. That would never happen.
Yeah, you can't wait to be king because you're going to die in that river.
All right. Other pixelated game coming out this week. Flint Hook. Brian, you downloaded this like right before we started the show.
Yeah, that's right. We were playing for a little bit at my desk before. I'm just a little bit into it. It's really, really cool. It's out now. It's sort of an action platforming game. Got like roguelike elements. The art direction is just completely off the chain for something that's pixelated. We see that sort of like retro pixelated look a lot, and it's not really like, sometimes people do it incredibly wrong. Like, the pixels are just the wrong sizes. They're all over the place. They're just like, it's a retro game. And you're like, you didn't play those games, did you? Yeah. These guys totally got it right. The soundtrack is phenomenal from what I've heard so far. And the hook is that you have a hook, and it's got this kind of Bionic Commando element to it, but with a lot more movement to it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was watching you play this, first thing you did is you're like, that's kind of weird. You can't use the D-pad, and then you get the hook, and it's like, oh, that's why, because you have full 360-degree movement, and you can, like, you know, swing on everything. But it's funny because everything still is very blocky and, you know.
Yep.
What I like about it is that it's very 16-bit kind of aesthetically, but color-wise, it's got like a huge range, so it looks much more like an old like LucasArts point and click.
Yeah, which is
very muted.
Which is smart, because I think when a lot of people try to emulate the old style of games, they go, well, the NES only had 256 colors on screen, and the Game Boy only had one. let's stick to that. But I think it's like, it's cool to take some liberties here and there, as long as I think like the pixel art is kind of on point. I'm very weird in particular.
What was that one Game Boy color? It was like unhealthy piss.
It was yak.
It was just, it was like old sepia, like just faded.
Yeah.
It was like didn't drink enough water.
Spinach puke.
Yeah.
Well, Sega used to like, it was like, they were doing like Tupac's Hit 'Em Up every other week, trying to be like, we got four colors on the game gear. What do you got? Puke? Yeah. They were, I love the 90s. It was a good time. String things, playing Cuban PS2.
Cuban PS2 in the 90s?
In the 90s.
Cuban PS2.
All right. So, Marty, Persona.
Yes. Yeah, so we talked, obviously Andrew talked at length about Persona with Zach a couple weeks ago. The rest of us pretty much remained silent because we let those two smart boys talk. Yeah, so it goes without saying the game is incredible, but I finally dug my teeth into it on Sunday. I restarted it. I was like, I'll play a couple hours. And I played 13 hours straight, is the most I've played of a game straight since the night The Last of Us, or we got Last of Us code, and I played through all of The Last of Us in one sitting, which I've talked about.
So what do you mean you restarted it?
I was like 2 hours in, but it was from like a month ago or something, and so I'm like, let's just, and then I got sidetracked by a bunch of stuff, and so I'm like, let's just restart, and so everything's fresh. Okay. And yeah, so totally the thing is, if you guys haven't started this yet, is there is sort of an entry fee, and it is a couple hours of your life that are very hand-holdy, and especially coming off Zelda, which Zelda is the immediate just like in media res, go have fun, you did it. Yep. Like even on the Great Plateau, even when you leave the Great Plateau, like it just immediately gives you freedom. The first couple hours of Persona 5, don't do that. But once it does it, the second I had freedom, which is like a day in the game, you know, goes through a calendar year. And it's I think it was a day in April, like almost today, probably to the date. It was probably like mid-April, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right, actually. Yeah.
And they're suddenly like, all right, so your goal, this is the palace. This is, you have whatever, 20 days to do this. Go have fun.
Yeah.
And then I started wandering around Tokyo, and every night I was doing something different after school. And during school, I was doing something different. And I was like, oh, do I want to raise one of my personal stats? Do I want to hang out with Ryuji? Do I want to...
Everything comes at the cost of something else.
Yes. Do I want to get a job to get money, or do I want to go inside the palace and start grinding and slowly chipping away at this? And it's one of those things where you have, whatever, think of it as three moves in a day, and you have 10 things you want to do, and I want to do all of them because all of them feed into each other to make it a better experience, and neglecting one of them is going to hurt the other. Mm-hmm. And that was how 3 hours became 13 hours, and I literally didn't leave my house on Sunday, and I just peed myself. No, I didn't pee myself. Didn't piss. I was really expecting.
I think you peed yourself.
I did not pee myself.
You put a little.
Now,
pee
I mean, I didn't. Now I definitely
I just put a little bit of pee on yourself. Yeah.
But it's one of those things. Like within that 13 hours, I just fell in love with all the characters. I fell in love with Morgana.
Who you're supposed to fall in love with all the characters. You're actually supposed to fall in love with one character. It's kind of weird.
So you know what I learned yesterday? For the first 13 hours, I thought Morgana was a girl.
What?
I still think Morgana's a girl. She's named Morgana and voiced by a woman.
So Morgana's not a girl. It's a cat. What?
Keep playing.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's why, like, people, it sounds insane to have put whatever 200 plus hours into that game, but it does. Like, it time goes away very quickly when you play that game, because you think of it as you finish a palace.
Way to describe time, it goes away.
No, I mean, it's like, I used to talk about Pac-Man Championship Edition DX when it came out.
Yep.
And, like, the joke was that game was like time traveling, because it was like, you would start it and be like, oh, I'm going to play a little bit before dinner, and you blink and it's 2 a.m.
I could not believe I put 13 hours in that
exactly.
game.
And it doesn't feel like it. And so it does. It like, as stupid as it sounds, it does make time feel like it goes faster, because, like, you're like, it's only been like 2 days in game. So you're like, oh, it's like I've probably been playing for an hour. And then you realize that you did so much in that time, or like you spent time with people, or like you watched cutscenes, or like if you go to Mementos or Palace, like you might play for 10 hours and it's only one in-game night, you know? So like time really does, like you pour more into it than you realize.
And I want everything. I want to capture, I want to negotiate and get every persona so that it helps me with my confidence. And I'm like sitting on the bus coming to work, and I'm thinking about like, oh, what do I need to do to raise my kindness so that An will talk to me? And I was in a cab to go see a game I could talk about next week, which is super cool. That I was, all I was thinking about was like, what am I going to do tonight after work? Like, I'm going to get home, and this is what I want to do with this day, and then I have to go to the second palace now, and I want to slowly chip away at it before raising a stat, because I want to start just banging characters.
Really getting it.
And that's where like this one is so much more well realized in terms of the like. Sorry, I've talked about Persona the banging. I've talked about Persona so much, so I'll shut up. But
they don't have sex.
They have implied sex.
No, but they literally have a fertility crisis over there because not enough Japanese teenagers are banging.
Isn't An American?
There's like some
part. I think there's like a weird. It, There's a weird balance to it that I don't think was in the previous games, because everything you're talking about feeds into one another in a way that is so much better than it was in 3 or 4. And I think, like, the way confidants influence gameplay lets you feel like you're not, like, it lets you feel like you're pouring your time into something that's complementary, which is really cool, rather than feeling like you've, like, 85 distinct things that you're doing.
Also, this is the only time I'm ever going to say this. Like, I'm torn between going on an actual date tonight and literally playing the game. Like, as of right now, I've not responded to the person because I kind of want to go home and play Persona.
You can do that.
Okay. Sorry that you've literally become me.
Yeah. Persona!
I'm really excited. Oh, my God. I got the Catherine skins now. This is going to be great.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. That's an awful, that was a weird sentence. Awful sentence.
I've got Catherine skin.
Oh. All right. Well... Yeah, anyway,
proud of you.
We have a segment we do here sometimes. It's called What VR Playing, and it is the games VR playing in virtual reality.
I think you missed our best one ever last week, Max.
Yeah, I think you did miss a lot.
I talked about the Safari VR game where the elephant
at
the same time. I wish you were here.
Brian, like, literally went into, like, a weird coma, talked about it for 10 minutes, and his last sentence was, "It's not great." I'm like, why did we spend that much time talking
about it? So,
Is this next game better than Not Great?
So, no animals poop and pee at the same time in this game.
There's a different bodily fluid, though, and it's called Starblood.
Gross.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Starblood Arena came out last week. And did you know that? You probably didn't know that because Sony told nobody. They put this game out. It's one of the flagship VR games
of this
boxed quarter.
Retail release.
It's a boxed retail release. Like, this is a legit $39.99 video game. It's really robust when it comes to single player and multiplayer. It's got great art direction, super, like, comfortable, awesome VR game, PSVR exclusive, and no one knows about it. Because Sony just put it out there.
I love that three bullet points are came out last week. Next bullet point. Did you know that? Next bullet point. Of course you didn't. Sony didn't tell anyone.
So I don't really understand what their plan is with PSVR all in all. And I don't want to, like, you know, get into this too much. But to go from being like, we have this new VR hat, to being like, you can't buy it anywhere, to being like, it works really well with Resident Evil 7, to other people being like, cool, I agree. What else can I play with it? To them being like, Farpoint next month? Like, where is this communication happening? Like, where is this breaking down? I don't understand. So that being said, this game's really cool. It feels, it's a first-person arena-based shooter. It's kind of Descent-inspired. It's got some sort of Overwatch-y character theme type of thing to it, where you pick different ships that all control differently and are all piloted by different pilots that you can level up and upgrade. It's one of the more comfortable VR games I've played, considering the insane things that you're doing in it, that you're rolling upside down and flipping around these arenas. It's also very, like, aesthetically really fun to look at. I look at something like Eve Valkyrie, which sort of feels like cold and dead in many ways.
That's what space is. It's cold and dead. Starblood Arena.
Which imagines that space should be fun and cool and full of, like, weird Star Wars aliens that yell at you from a couch. So I think it's doing a lot of cool stuff. The problem with this game is that it's multiplayer-centric, and when no one knows about a game that's multiplayer-centric, no one is on the servers playing it, and then it's not a multiplayer-centric game anymore. So my biggest trouble with this game has been trying to connect to a match because Sony didn't tell anyone it exists.
Yeah.
So that's a bad catch-22. That said, there's some cool single-player stuff. I really dig it. I'm not sure if there's a demo or not, but you should watch some trailers for it and see if it's something you're interested in. If you're looking for a kind of meatier VR game to play right now, like, that's the one. Yeah. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that came out on PSVR recently that's sort of short or feels sort of like VR tourism, like that weird Safari animal pee thing that I talked about last week.
Oh, the Brian Fellow simulator.
But yeah, look into this. I played it at PSX and I really dug it, and I was really surprised to see it just sort of out there one day. So yeah, it's out now. Go check it out if you're interested in something cool and new for your PSVR.
I think the future of PSVR and how much Sony is going to put muscle behind it is going to be really telling at E3. Yeah. How much of their conference / how much of their booth is going to be VR, or how much is going to be them being like, look at all these third parties we've aligned with, and here's Spider-Man and God of War.
I agree. Like, we saw that quote a couple weeks ago from Sony saying that they wanted to sort of invest more in putting VR in public spaces, such as, like, arcades and stuff. Museums.
Yeah. Lavatories.
Yeah, anything you want that's a public space. So I don't know if they're pivoting towards that direction. But even then, like, you need to tell people about your games.
Yep.
So, like, just being like, we have a cool hat is not enough. Like, people are like, what does it do?
You really need to start making some of these free for PlayStation Plus.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
It should be a vertical in, yep. Yeah. In PS Plus. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, get rid of one of the PS3 games or both. Are there still PS3 games?
Yeah.
Get rid of
them. There still are Vita games.
Do you think we'd ever see a like a announcement for a PSVR bundle that maybe comes with something like this?
I really hope so. I mean, we saw the launch bundle came with Worlds, which I think was a great way of sort of showing off what that thing can do.
Yeah.
But it's really all about the experiences. And if you don't have those there, there's no purpose, right?
I mean, I'm hoping that they have like... I would love if at E3 they took a lot of like stuff like Dreams or Knack 2 or a lot of like Hot Shots and all this stuff that's coming. If you step back and you were like, what can we do in VR? And yeah. made like a lot of these first party things that are a little smaller that maybe aren't quite as exciting to people and bundled them together with the PSVR. I think that's how you could drum up interest in those things.
Yeah, throw the Battlefront X-Wing mission on there. Yeah. Throw like a level from Bound on there.
Dude, I don't think we're going to get a PSVR 2 this fall.
Yep.
But no, I do think if they want to move units, what they do is if they're not going to drop price, they bundle it with $100 worth of cool games. Batman, something like this, something that runs the gamut of here is a little bit of everything you can do with it.
Yeah. One thing I saw recently, which is not necessarily indicative of the success or failures of PSVR, but there was a game called Tethered, which I talked about on this show. It's sort of a god mode world building simulator where you control these little aliens on this platform by using your head and like physically looking at where you want them to go. The developers just created a new version of the game called Untethered, which is non-VR. So they basically created a non-VR version of their own game where VR, to me, felt like the entire hook. And now it's just not. So you have that option. So I'm wondering if we're going to start to see something like that. Like, Starblood Arena is awesome in VR, but without it, it's a really cool, really competent arena-based shooting game. So maybe if something doesn't live the first time in VR, they'll just put out a non-VR version of it.
Yeah. Anyways, that's a Tearaway. Tearaway is a game I don't think anything could be more literally built around a system the way Tearaway was for Vita, and they managed to put on PS4. Right.
And they adapted it.
So totally. I hope that, like, in lieu of PSVR hopefully succeeding, but if it does happen to fail, I do hope that these games get, like, sort of a second life.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Maybe Second Life will
come out. No one wants Second Life.
I think a lot of people would. There's all kinds of weird stuff you can do in there. Anyway, now it's time for Rapid Fire. Rapid Fire is, of course, when we take your questions from the Podcast Beyond Facebook group, which is facebook.com/group/podcastbeyond.
Groups.com.
Or groups.net.
What is groups.com?
It's probably like an orgy website.
Yeah, I don't know. It's over there.
Orgy, glad to meet me.
Anyway, like our people have been clicking on the site like crazy. I don't know what's going on.
Real good links. Anyway, Will Pratt asks, with Nintendo not making NES classics anymore, wouldn't this be an opportunistic time for Sony to create a PS1 peripheral that consumers could buy and reinvigorate nostalgia?
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is a great idea, but I don't know if anyone has as much nostalgia for the PS1 as they do for Sony's most notable.
Also, no, console. I mean,
yes, human PS2.
Look, unfortunately, like, I think no. I think Nintendo, I love Nintendo and I love those NES games, and Classic was cool, but it was cool because Nintendo has a lack of a connected ecosystem. Like, truthfully, like, Sony doesn't need it. They don't need a standalone thing because I have 10 devices I can play Sony games on.
But if they sold a little thing like this that was shaped like a PS1, like the
novelty
OLED
of it. But I think, honestly, like, putting 30 games out on something that doesn't connect to the internet for Sony would be a step backwards. Whereas for Nintendo, it was one-stop shopping for virtual console games, basically, because you can't buy some of those right now. Yeah. But for Sony, like, on my Vita right now, I can get the 30 best PS1 games. I would rather see them bundle them for $10 and let me buy it that way.
Let's be honest here. The least interesting thing about the NES Mini was the fact that it played video games. Like, aesthetically, the form factor of that thing is what everybody was hunting down.
I agree with that.
Because if you wanted those games, spoilers, you can find them anywhere. Like, you just type in Mario 3 ROM and
At that point, like, it would be just as cool if Sony made a little cute $10 PS1 toy that came with a $20 PSN gift card or something.
Yeah, like, I agree with that.
I don't think they need to limit themselves the way NES Classic
also
limited.
Okay, so yeah, going back, playing my own devil's advocate, I sort of agree with you where the NES Classic had a market that was people who were nostalgic for the NES, but who maybe don't play games anymore.
Right, yeah.
Or don't own a Nintendo console anymore. Yeah. Whereas I feel like a lot of people who are that nostalgic for the PS1 are probably still on board.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people I know who played Final Fantasy VII and Metal Gear Solid and, you know, and Crash Bandicoot are still playing
because it's video games. I think that's exactly it. Because it's like a generation later, like I think where NES Classic should have been wasn't GameSpot or GameStop and Amazon and stuff like that. It should have been at like Walgreens. Yeah, it should have been like exactly. Yeah. And I think like
saying this from since launch, but it should be on end caps of
and PS1 isn't
stores.
That. Like I don't think the audience, like my dad wanted an NES Classic. He was looking for one to buy at retail price and couldn't because he remembers Mario and he wants games like that.
Was he a big Blasto fan?
He was a huge Blasto fan. I don't think with PS1 you have that audience. I don't think it could work in the same way.
Well, maybe not in the same.
I think the people who are that audience have a PS4.
Yeah.
Possibly. I think it's really discounting the amount of lapsed gamers there are in the world. I mean, we're so embedded into that ecosystem every single day that it's hard for us to see the forest from the trees. But I think there's a lot of people that are just used to play video games, don't play them anymore.
Yeah.
If they walked into a store and they saw like a tiny PS1 with 20 games on it for $60, maybe they jump on that. I mean, it's hard to say,
but
right?
Not in the same way. I don't think it would be flying off shelves in the same way. I just don't think that audience exists in this.
Well, it's tough to sell. You can't actually tell because Nintendo never made this thing possible. Like you can't. There's no way to say like what can we compare this to because Nintendo made this impossible.
Yeah.
Like there's we can't actually track the success of this thing because every one they made sold out, but they sold out in weird ways. Like within seconds on online. Like no one actually bought one on a store shelf.
Yeah. Totally.
Like, they were gone in seconds.
Yep.
Also worth pointing out that just from a technical standpoint, I think that stuff that like getting 8-bit games to run on like a little piece of hardware is considerably less like tweaking in QA than to get like 3D games running.
Yeah.
Something that ran off of optical media versus a cartridge. That's a different animal. That would be very tricky to do. I'm sure that people can do that with Raspberry Pi and stuff. But
it's true. It's running a bunch of different engines.
Yeah,
which
just on the basis of it uses more power, you're going to have to pay more for it. And then
Totally.
It's also trickier when it comes to third-party stuff. And I know Nintendo got some third-party stuff on the NES Classic, but I don't know. It's interesting. I
would buy one 100%. I would be so curious to see what something like it would kind of test the strength of that brand and ecosystem against Nintendo's. And I feel like, especially when you're talking the NES specifically, like that just means something that PS1 doesn't.
That's a thing, and that's a pillar of pop culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Jacob Vauder, we know there are a few Star Wars games in the works, but what would you like to see in a Star Wars game that isn't already announced? I am personally eagerly awaiting a single-player RPG in the same mold as KOTOR. No offense to The Old Republic. I think it's a great game. I just prefer single-player games.
Right. I would love a single-player Star Wars RPG and also a Criterion pod racing game.
I think Criterion pod racing is kind of what's up.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. It'd be cool as hell. It doesn't have to be like a wide-open world kind of thing. Just give me like a beautiful, fast... Give me like an F-Zero knockoff with Star Wars.
The most amazing destruction. Like that.
I really liked where 1313 was heading.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Like, sort of like grimy underworld type. And we've seen games where you can play as the bad guys, and we've seen games where you play as, you know, Starkiller and Jango Fett. But I do want that sort of like grimy, seedy Jabba the Hutt underworld.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think we're going to get, genre-wise, we're going to get that in Visceral's game, and I would love to see it be a little bit like, here's my thing with Star Wars. It is such a gigantic universe, like, and it's a galaxy, but I mean, I'm using the word universe in terms of like the pantheon of Star Wars. And that's why, like, when everyone talks about like Rey's parents in Force Awakens, like, I don't want to be Luke. I don't want to be Obi-Wan. I don't want to be anyone we've heard of. Like, I want to explore stories. Like, Rogue One was cool, but just tell me something completely new. You know, we're getting this Han Solo prequel. We're getting all of these things to fill in that part we know about, and it sounds like Battlefront 2 will be more complimentary to that. I totally agree. What I was excited with 1313, even before the Boba Fett stuff came to light, was like, just give me a brand new, completely standalone Star Wars story. Like, that's what I want out of a game.
Yeah.
I'd love to see something maybe set in the sort of Rebels Clone Wars era, but without that aesthetic.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Maybe BioWare. I mean, dude, throw BioWare a Star Wars game. And have them make it in Frostbite. You know, I feel like they've come a long way from KOTOR.
That'd be awesome,
So, you know. Harry Lloyd, how do I say? I always
Harry Lazidus.
What is your favorite weapon in Star Wars?
I really like the string thing. I think that's a really good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I love thermal detonators. They're super cool.
They're cool.
It's just like, I love the way they click in with each other. It looks like the kind of thing that'd be weird, like when you see those old like war veteran guys that have like old like grenades on their shelf. Like
the sound effect of it too.
Oh, the sound effect's awesome.
Yeah. Like Chewie's bowcaster was really cool in Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm. That cool time Han was like, can I fire that thing I've been hanging out with for 70 years? Can I try your gun for the first time?
That was dumb. I love Boba Fett's gun. I hate it in Battlefront. It's just like, it shoots like three shots. And you're like,
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Aesthetically, I think Han's blaster is like super iconic.
It's really cool. That too. I like Rey's NN14. The little Han's blaster.
It was actually really interesting seeing, I forget his name, but dude in Rogue One. Force-sensitive man. I really like the idea of like melee weapons that aren't lightsabers in the Star Wars universe, because I honestly feel like... In Force Awakens and Rogue One, it was kind of the first time I thought about the fact that like you have to respond to blasters without lightsabers sometimes, and like that stormtrooper thing I thought was really cool.
The traitor thing.
Yeah.
Totally worth mentioning here. I actually went and shot a video that isn't up yet, but... we went to a shooting range that had some vintage weapons. They had a British Sterling machine gun, and they had an MG-34, which both are guns that got turned into Star Wars blasters.
Right.
The Sterling got turned into the E-11 Stormtrooper blaster, and the MG-34 is what you see Chewie and Han and Luke running around the Death Star with, those big heavy things. We didn't get to shoot the MG-34 because it was broken, because it's like 70 years old or whatever, but I got to fire off a Sterling while dressed like Han Solo, which was kind of cool.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it was incredibly weird to be like, here's a gun that I had like toys of growing up. Like the MG-34 is the thing that like Forlom and Dengar carry. It's like kind of the weird sort of throwaway extra weapon.
Yeah.
And I always was like, oh, they probably like, I don't know, they just carry it. It probably doesn't weigh a whole lot. That thing is like solid old steel, and it weighs 35 pounds, not loaded.
You need robot arms, man.
Our grandpas were much stronger than we were.
Many ways. Yeah. Emotionally.
It also just makes like, I want to watch Star Wars again and just see how people are carrying it and being like, oh, that makes more sense now. I just thought that like Mark Hamill was just like a weird, goofy dude running around like that.
Also, like a really quick aside, a half an hour ago when I said we wouldn't talk about Star Wars E3, I apologize.
Whoops. All right. Paul D. Burt. You shut up over there.
Paul D. Burt.
Damn it.
We're so far over.
Paul D. Blurt? Maul Flirt?
Right. You know, many gaming regimes as professionals, you probably do things differently. Drink in a snack, a particular seat.
Get home, sit in my chair, put on my Cuban PS2, and pop open a big old pouch of Strang Fangs.
All right, well, that answers that question. Joshua Nedich says, will we see a PSVR pod racing game? You guys can stop drooling now.
Star Wars.
You want Criterion to do it.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
That'd be cool. I'd love to see kind of the approach that... Was this what they were sort of screwing with Kinect, where they were like, it's a bunch of experiences in Star Wars?
I love that.
And then don't you dare mention Star Wars Kinect.
What, VR dancing?
The part where you're like, oh, you get to be a Rancor.
Do you know that was the last single-player Star Wars game before?
I do, yeah.
That's so insane.
Dark times. I mean, people talk about the Dark Ages in the mid-90s before Star Wars came back with the special editions and the prequels and all that. But there was a Dark Ages between Revenge of the Sith and Force Awakens, where we got stuff like Star Wars Kinect, like the second Dark Ages of Star Wars.
Yep.
Those were rough times, and I'm very happy to be out of
it. I think Wars movie?
The X-Men experience we got from Criterion for Battlefront like felt like being an X-Wing pilot in a way that sounds really stupid, but like when you sit down and do it, like you're looking around the cockpit and it feels so good. Like if they could do that with other vehicles,
do that animal game you played last week, but it's with Star Wars animals,
that
like
would be Dubaks. Awesome.
Poops and peeps.
I would love that. I think
like Pokemon Snap,
I think that VR and Star Wars are like a perfect combination.
Yep.
We already have the X-Wing thing from Battlefront, but there's the ILM X Labs, which is where they're making like weird VR experiences. I got to do one of them at Celebration. They had this weird booth, and this is like a convention exclusive thing where basically you just played with BB-8, and it was kind of like, it was a lot like the HTC Vive like lab experience, where there's that like little dog ball thing running around, and you're just interacting with it and being like, you can like, you know, pet BB-8, and you're just in this room. It's like maybe 4 minutes long, and there's not really a lot to it, but I feel like packaging a bunch of those things together and being like, hey, it's It's like PSVR Worlds, but it's Star Wars.
Yeah.
That would immediately get people's attention.
Especially when you're talking about a time when they're thinking about doing all the different eras and all, like, there's more for them to mine than just, you know, three movies now. Like, there's so much that they could do, and pod racing is a great example, and so many other weird things that, like, have been locked to one movie, and especially if it's in the prequels, like, no one wants to talk about it, but, like, I think there's more there.
Yeah. Anyway, that's our show for you today. You can find us all on Twitter. I'm Max Scoville. Brian is Agent Bizzle. Andrew is Garfep. And Marty, you're McBiggity with two G's and two T's.
I am.
And if you like our show, you should check out some of the other shows we do here. Brian, you're on NVC, which is all about Nintendo.
Yep.
Things like that. And you also do Game Scoop here and there.
Yep. And Link Together.
Yeah, Link Together.
Up at Noon with you.
We do Up at Noon. That's right. Yep. And Goldfarb, what else do you do?
I'm occasionally on GameScoop. I was recently on our friend's Kind of Funny's Gamescast cool. with an S in the middle. I did that.
I believe I'm doing that soon.
And you're also killing yourself running news on a regular basis. So.
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah. what do you do here? What exactly would you say you do? And Marty, you're on Unlocked, which is all about Xbox and things like that.
Yes.
You do that with Alana and and McCaffrey and all that.
Yeah.
I do Up at Noon with Brian. Check out the Celebration coverage you put up. I did a bunch of weird videos about Dubacks and Chadra fans and whatnot.
Tons of really cool stuff.
And that's it. So Beyond. Hooray. It's over.
Here's a quick question for you. How did you sleep last night? If your battle for a good night's sleep feels relentless, I have the answer. It's a podcast called Sleepwave, with meditations and hypnosis created to help you fall asleep. My relaxation techniques will help you feel calm and ready for sleep, with soft music that will help you fall asleep in minutes. Most listeners never hear the end of an episode, so search Sleepwave on your favorite podcast app and find out why over a million people have fallen asleep to my voice.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.